ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy, certainly staying sane. I know we're all ready for things to at least begin getting back to some semblance of normalcy. I do want to mention, I really appreciate everyone listening. So we've actually had record downloads over the past 2 months or so, probably because all of you are just that bored in quarantine. But seriously, really appreciate it. And again, hope you're managing okay with everything going on right now. Okay, so I have three excellent guests for you this week. I'm going to start with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy. We're going to talk gold and gold ETFs. Gold has been one of the best performing assets this year. It's up about 12%. And so no surprise, gold ETFs have been a popular place for investors. We've seen record demand here. So Sumeet and I are going to look at the different gold ETFs. We'll talk about that performance. And if we have time, I also want to touch on the gold miners as well. I'll then be joined by Ed Rosenberg, head of ETFs at American Century Investments, who a few weeks ago, they became the first fund company to launch non-transparent ETFs. So at long last, these things are finally out in the wild. And I'm going to try to cover it all with Ed. I want to find out why he thinks these ETFs are needed. I want to understand how American Century is pricing these just in terms of fund fees and whether that presents any sort of issue for their mutual fund lineup. We'll definitely discuss what these should be called, right? So if you listen to the podcast last week, you heard Drew Voros and I get into a debate on this. I want to get Ed's take. We'll also discuss whether the daily transparency of traditional ETFs is overrated, because Ed made some comments on CNBC a couple of weeks ago that definitely caught my attention on whether daily transparency really even matters to investors. So again, I'm going to try to cover it all. And if you haven't heard Ed before, I've got to tell you, you're in for a treat. Ed is very colorful, definitely not afraid to hold back. And of course, everyone knows I've been somewhat skeptical of non-transparent ETFs, so this should be a fun conversation. And then to close this week, another tremendous guest, actually one of my favorites, Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise Investments. He's going to discuss how Bitcoin has held up during the recent market turmoil. We'll also talk investment case moving forward. And Bitwise is currently working on making their Bitwise 10 crypto index fund available in traditional brokerage accounts, so at places like Schwab and Fidelity. So I'll have Matt explain that as well. As always, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can go to etfprime.com. Let's start with etf.com, Sumeet Roy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at etf.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
Just like with the stock, it's a function of the volume of the security. You can often put your limit order in between those two prices. That's if you're still concerned about how do you value cryptocurrencies.
Sumeet, great having you back on the podcast. How have you been doing over the past month or so?
Pleasure to be here, Nate. Thanks so much for having me. Just trying to hang in there, you know, like everyone else.
And I have to ask you, I've asked everybody who comes on the podcast, what is your work from home setup right now?
Absolutely the same as my normal setup. I've been working from home for over a decade. So in that way, this has been a pretty easy transition for me.
Well, good. Okay, so we're going to talk gold. And by the way, I have to mention, I am really glad we're not covering oil ETFs this week, because I don't think we could keep up with the headlines there. Perhaps it'll be a topic for next week with what's going on with USO right now. But as it relates to gold, as I mentioned, gold is up about 12% year to date, which I don't think is a huge surprise given everything going on in the markets. We do know gold can be a safe haven, but you know, you're talking what, a 20 to 25% performance differential between gold and something like the S&P 500 this year. High level, what's been going on here?
Right, Nate. So we did see gold. It hit a 7-year high last week above 1720 per ounce. It's come down a little bit from there. But it seems to me that gold has become essentially this generic safe haven asset, somewhat similar to treasuries. And incidentally, if you compare the performance of gold, it's up 11% year to date. And that's pretty much the same return you would have got in IEF, the iShares 7 to 10 year treasury product. That's also up around 11%. So it's kind of interesting to see that they've been moving in, not in lockstep, but pretty much similarly throughout the year. So historically, when we were talking about gold, we talked about it as a hedge against inflation. But I think recently, over the last 10 years, or maybe a little bit longer, the metals hedging capabilities, they've kind of broadened to where now you're talking about gold as being this hedge against all manner of financial and economic problems. You know, things like deflation, black swans, huge stock market sell-offs, things like that. Investors talk about using gold to hedge against all of those. And then now, on top of all that, is getting this extra boost from the fact that interest rates on government bonds are close to zero or even less than zero, as investors are well aware, at least in the developed countries. So that's reduced the opportunity cost of holding gold compared to bonds, government bonds, in the past, because in the past, government bonds, they'd be yielding, 2, 3, 4, 5%. So you'd be getting that yield, and that would be much more favorable than gold, which is giving you zero yield. Now that it's a much more level playing field with both yielding zero, I think that works in gold's favor. But, you know, why are investors flocking to gold? Why do they even consider it a safe haven in the first place? I don't think there's a particular reason for that, Nate. I think, you know, there's this collective belief among people in general that gold is scarce, it's valuable, it's resilient, and it's preserved its value over, you know, many, many centuries. So in that way, gold has always been considered a good store of value. But what has changed over the past 16 years is, of course, the introduction of gold ETFs, and that's made the metal even more liquid, even more accessible than it already was. So now it's extremely easy for anyone to buy gold, including those who, like me, probably wouldn't go out otherwise and buy physical gold. So that's helped amplify gold safe haven properties.
Yeah, and I want to get to the ETF side of the story here in just a moment. You mentioned one of the reasons investors may look to gold is traditionally it's been somewhat of a hedge against inflation. And I think it's really hard to envision now because I think more investors are probably worried about deflation than inflation. But I have seen this narrative out there that with all the stimulus, right, the Fed intervention, we've seen, the government stimulus package that perhaps it could lead to inflation down the road. How much do you think that's playing a role in demand for gold right now?
I think there could be some of that. I mean, that's certainly what we saw in the aftermath of the financial crisis. That was really the first time that the Fed unleashed these huge quantitative easing programs with trillions of dollars. And for many years after that, there was this belief that the Fed's, quote, money printing would lead to rapid inflation. And it's a large part of what fueled gold's rise to that record we saw in 2011 above $1,920. But most investors are now aware that rapid inflation that was anticipated after 2008, 2009, it never materialized. And that's due to a lot of factors, you know, like demographic forces and things like that. And the economy, in fact, didn't have rapid inflation. It was the opposite. We were struggling to generate any inflation at all. And I think once the market realized that, that's when we had that big gold sell-off between 2011 and 2015, there was no inflation, and frankly, there's little need to hedge against anything during that great bull market. So obviously today there's many more risks, so you know investors are getting back into gold. And could inflation be one of those risks? I mean, we can never completely rule that out. But if the last cycle is any guide, then like you said, Nate, deflation is probably more of a concern than inflation.
Okay, so as it pertains to ETFs, there has been record demand for gold ETFs. Give us some perspective here, just in terms of flows and maybe which ETFs have stood out.
So if you look on a year-to-day basis, flows into U.S.-listed gold ETFs, it's about $11 billion. And if you go back 1 year, it's about $21 billion worth of inflows, so quite substantial. And then, of course, the biggest flows are going into the usual suspects, GLD and IAU. Their year-to-day flows are around $6.8 billion for GLD and $2.7 billion for IAU. But there's also some newcomers that are picking up assets. We have the SPDR Gold Mini Shares Trust, GLDM, which is the cheaper sister product for GLD. That has year-to-date inflows of $730 million. And then the Aberdeen Standard Physical Gold Shares ETF, SGOL, that picked up $350 million. And even the Granite Shares Gold Trust, BAR, had $150 million of inflows, which is pretty solid for a product of that size. So all three of those ETFs, they have among the lowest expense ratios among the gold ETF segment, around 17 to 18 basis points. So it's, in that respect, is not surprising to see them get a little bit of traction. But I also just want to point out that the inflows we're seeing for gold ETFs, it's not just a U.S. phenomenon. The World Gold Council, they estimated that just in the first quarter, $23 billion flowed into gold ETFs globally. And that's in the U.S., in Europe. There's a lot of demand for gold, especially in places like France, the U.K., Switzerland, and many other places in Europe and Asia.
You know, the gold ETF category, though, is really interesting to me. I was looking last week, and you were alluding to this, but if you look over the past few years, there have been several new entrants into this space, ETFs like BAR, which you mentioned. There's the Perth Mint Physical Gold ETF, ticker AAAU. Of course, Mini GLD, right? The Spider Gold Mini Shares GLDM that you mentioned. And they all have been pretty successful in raising assets. And I don't think you always see that in different ETF categories. You can pick the theme or whatever, and you may see one or two have some success, and then the other ones sort of fall by the wayside. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the gold ETF category, you have all of these entrants able to find at least some semblance of success?
I mean, that's an interesting point you bring up, Nate. They have all generally been pretty successful. And I think that's because they're all offering some sort of value to investors. We just talked about, you know, those three GLDM, SGOL, BAR. And those are obviously pretty valuable to investors because they're essentially giving the same exposure as GLD, but they're much, much cheaper. Then you have other ones like OUNZ. That gives you gold exposure, but it gives you the ability for individual investors to redeem their shares for physical gold. So all these ETFs are offering something above and beyond what GLD or IAU is offering. And so I think that's why you're seeing them gain a little bit of traction.
What about the ETN that launched in October of last year? It is zero fee, by the way, the iPath Gold ETN, ticker GBUG, which I love. I believe this has around maybe $35 million in assets. Do you think this will continue gaining traction?
I mean, it is an interesting product. You know, I'm of two minds of it. I mean, on the one hand, it has no fee, which is obviously something that investors should love. On the other hand, it is an ETN, so it has credit risk, and it's an iPath commodity ETN, and we generally haven't seen those be very popular with investors. There's a lot of iPath commodity ETNs out there that have hardly any assets. So there's going to be that push and pull between those two forces. I think in the end, it's probably going to do okay. It'll probably accumulate, you know, something like $100 million to $1 billion in assets, but I mean, that's just my wild guess.
Do you think the main value proposition here is just the tax treatment and that the ETN is taxed at the normal short and long-term capital gains rate versus gold as a collectible?
I think that's a big selling point for sure. I mean, you combine that with the no fee, and I mean, that's a huge selling point. So you got to weigh that against the credit risk and maybe even the lack of liquidity, at least in the short term.
By the way, this is completely off topic, but I keep talking about it. I still think that Vanguard should launch a gold ETF. I'm actually surprised that they haven't launched one yet, just to compete with State Street and iShares. And some people may say, well, that's not really Vanguard's cup of tea. But then I would remind you, they have a commodity strategy mutual fund, and we've now seen them, you know, dip their toe into private equity. So I'm going to keep that on my list of predictions. I do think we'll see a Vanguard gold ETF at some point. Side note. Sumeet, going back to GLD and really some of the other gold ETFs, I've seen a little bit of chatter out there that these don't always trade in line with their net asset value, that they can disconnect a little bit during the day. Do you want to briefly explain that?
So, yeah, there is a little misconception about that. The fact is GLD's NAV is based on the London PM fix price. And that's determined around 10 a.m. Eastern time every day. So you have about 6 hours between when that NAV is set at 10 a.m. and when Wall Street, U.S. stock markets close at 4 p.m. So obviously the NAV is going to become pretty stale pretty quickly after 10 a.m. But the ETF price is going to keep moving to reflect the constant change in gold price. But, you know, even with that discrepancy, when you look at GLD's price compared to the NAV on any given day, there's usually only a 2% premium or discount at the most. And most of the time, it's well below that. But again, you know, the premium or discount is misleading. It's just a function of the NAV being set at a specific time that's different than the closing time of the ETF.
Yeah, no, and I just wanted to bring that up because I have seen some, again, chatter out there, and you know, people may misconstrue that as the ETF's not functioning properly. And to your point, it's really just a timing difference in terms of the underlying market. Mm-hmm. And I guess while we're on this this topic of ETF education, I also will occasionally see the conspiracy theorists out there who don't believe gold ETFs actually own the physical gold bars. Is there any comfort you can offer them?
I mean, I don't think there's anything I can say, Nate, that's going to satisfy the conspiracy theorist. But, yeah, there are a lot of checks and balances that ensure that GLD really does hold all that gold. I mean, for one, the trust is regulated by the SEC. They regularly file 10-Qs and 10-Ks with the commission. So that alone should be somewhat reassuring, even for the conspiracy theorist. But if that's not enough, you know, we see that the trust custodian who actually holds the gold, that's HSBC, one of the largest banks in the world. Then you have a third-party firm, Inspectorate International, and they specialize in inspections and testing, and they do two counts of the gold every year. One's a complete count that takes place on September 30th, and then there's another random sample count that takes place on another day of the year. And then finally, you have Bank of New York Mellon. That's the trustee. They do a lot of administration stuff, but they also monitor the custodian, HSBC. So you have a lot of layers of accountability there.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot. You're an ETF analyst, you're an ETF expert. I know you know the commodity space inside and out. Do you believe the gold ETFs actually have the underlying gold?
Absolutely. I believe it.
All right, very, very good. Hey, Sumeet, just a couple of minutes left before I let you go. What about the gold mining ETF? So something like the VanEck Vectors Gold Miners ETF, ticker GDX, or even the Junior Miners GDXJ. Any quick thoughts or comments on those?
So we haven't really seen anything too noteworthy there. I took a look at the flows in that segment the other day, and we saw GDX, it has about $1 billion of outflows year to date. GDXJ, it's had about $300 million of outflows year to date. But both ETFs have underperformed GLD and the gold actual physical commodity. I think GDXJ is down year to date. GDX is up a little bit, 5% or so. So that's obviously less than 11% that GLD is up. And I really don't see this underperformance changing anytime soon. Historically, gold miners have underperformed the actual physical commodity. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think the biggest reason is poor governance in the industry. Generally speaking, these companies have not been managed very well, so I don't see that necessarily changing anytime soon.
Well, and we've talked before about how you may look at gold miners as a sort of a leverage play on gold, and that can be the case if you have the price of gold really taking off. But I think to your point, you can't forget about the underlying company risk, the equity risk, the risk of management, mm-hmm. governance. And so even if gold is doing well, that's not just an automatic that the gold miners will perform, any better.
Sumeet,
excellent stuff this week. Always appreciate your coverage of the commodity space and certainly look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com, Sumeet Roy. All right, my next guest is Ed Rosenberg, head of ETFs at American Century Investments, who currently has 12 ETFs under their umbrella, over $1.4 billion invested. Of course, American Century is a huge player on the mutual fund side with nearly $160 billion in total assets. But earlier this month, they launched the first quote-unquote semi-transparent ETFs. These had been a long time in the making, and Ed is now on the line with me from Chicago. Ed, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining me this week.
Well, thank you for having me.
Ed, so on April 2nd, American Century did launch the first semi-transparent ETFs, the Focus Dynamic Growth ETF, ticker symbol FDG, and the Focus Large Cap Value ETF, ticker FLV. Both are using the Precidian Active Share structure, which we can talk about that in a moment. But first, how's everything going so far with these ETFs? How are they trading? What sort of investor reception have they had?
Everything's been going really well. The investor reception's been great. To give you an example, the funds started out with about $4 million each. FLV today in 2 weeks has grown to a little over $11 million. FDG is a little over $7 million. And the trading volume across the board has been very well, about 20,000 shares a day or more for both products. And the better part of that is, quite frankly, the markets have been volatile, as you know, Nate, and the spreads have maintained at about 10 cents wide. So the investors have had a great experience across the board, and the demand has been there.
Can you talk a little bit more about the trading? Because I know prior to the launch of these, I think that was one of the concerns out there. And I know a lot of the market observers, ETF observers, were really going to watch how these things traded intraday. Can you offer any more insight into that?
Oh, absolutely. So this was the what everyone talked to me about was the great unknown. How would these be priced and how would these trade? And so as I mentioned, the spread, right, you're talking the 10 cents translates to about an average of 23 basis points. And market makers have been pricing these very well. And if you think of what makes up a spread, just to go into a little detail, there's three main components, right? It's the spread and the underlyings. Now, these are large cap securities. Normally, a base spread of the underlying securities can be anywhere from 1.25 cents to 1.75. And then when you get in these volatile environments like we're in, you're probably talking 2.5 to 3 cents wide for the underlyings, just in general, with large cap. Then you have other components, creation costs, which get embedded into the spread. And creation costs, just so you know, can be as low as $75, or as I've seen some as high as $40,000, $45,000. The last piece is carry costs. 66% of all ETFs trade less than 50,000 shares a day, and the average creation unit size is 25,000, 50,000, 100,000. There are some as high as 600,000. And when you get that, if the ETF is trading 20,000 shares a day because it's buy and hold and not a hedge vehicle, you can actually see carry costs play into the spread. What we've done with these is, one, the creation size is only 5,000 shares, which comes out to about $220,000. So market makers don't have to carry, and there is no creation cost. It's zero, which is where we set it. And quite frankly, it just means that the spread you get on the open market and lead market maker Citadel, what they've done is they've priced in the spread of what they think the underlyings are plus the unknown. And that's why you've seen the spread so tight, because it's large cap securities. And we don't have those other two issues. It's really just what they think the underlyings are going to be plus some unknown.
Okay, so I think the bottom line here is these things have really traded without a hitch and done so in a pretty volatile market environment.
Absolutely. And just so you know, Nate, it's not even just the little trades. We did have someone bought $5 million of FLV last week. Trade went off using a block desk at 5 cents under what the ask was.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about the actual investment strategies underlying these two ETFs.
Absolutely. So let's start with FLV. I mean, the whole premise here is it's targeting attractively priced companies with high quality assets, low financial leverage, and franchise stability. It's a more concentrated portfolio. You're looking at probably 30 to 50 names, and they're differentiated by providing a lower beta. And they do a lot of downside analysis. They're trying to make sure there's less downside risk and more upside capture if they can. For focused dynamic growth, it's a fundamental research that identifies companies early. This is the key. It's early to rapid phases of growth. So they don't want to own a company that has, you know, is sort of long in the tooth on the growth side. They want to believe it's early to rapid phases of growth. And they're only going to own, again, 30 to 40 names. So it's very concentrated. And it's specifically targeting that quick growth, which is what we've seen. I'd say we probably got picked the right time to launch, but is what we've seen out of the products. The other thing I'll point out is the expense ratio on both. FLV is 42 basis points, and FDG is 45. And, you know, knowing the marketplace, these are what I would call half the price of some of our roughly competitors, even in the index space.
And I'm curious, are these strategies currently offered in existing American Century mutual funds, or are these new strategies altogether?
So the FDG is an existing mutual fund. So the answer is yes. Okay. FDG is an existing fund. The closest expense ratio on the funds that we have is 50 basis points, so it's only a slight bit lower. And it will be a little bit different, just so you know. The mutual fund itself will invest in some international securities. These ETFs, the way they were approved by the SEC, they cannot. So they can use an ADR if there's a substitute. If there's not, it has to invest in something else. And so it'll be similar to the fund, but it won't be the same.
Okay, so let's talk more about the semi-transparent structure itself. And obviously, the high-level idea here is to protect the intellectual property of these investment strategies, right? So other investors can't front-run trades or copy the stock picks. Now, I'm sure this won't surprise you. I am going to play a little devil's advocate here. And I've got to tell you, every time I've had an active manager on this podcast who uses the transparent ETF wrapper, which obviously that has daily disclosure, I always ask them whether fears of front running or reverse engineering the strategy are legitimate. And they've all answered the same way, which is they basically say those fears are overblown, that this just isn't an issue. So give us the counter argument. Why do you disagree with that, and why do you believe daily disclosure can be an issue?
So let's start out with, I'm going to say their funds aren't, a lot of those funds probably are not in the billions yet, because there are certain securities that you may own that you can't trade in and out of in a single day. So somebody can front run that. And I'll give you an example. At one of my previous locations, and it was an index fund where it was proprietary, we used to publish the index changes prior to them actually going out. And the portfolio managers noticed some strange behavior with some of those securities. And once they stopped publishing the holdings, they noticed that strange behavior stopped. And they realized that they were taking a hit of anywhere about 50 basis points each quarter every time they published it to somebody front-running the actual changes to an index. Now, this is just an index. This isn't even active. And once they stopped, there were trading firms that actually called, and these were small shops, not the big ones, asking to buy the data because they were obviously making money, and there wasn't a price we could charge, one, that would be good for the investors, quite frankly, because they're hurting the performance, and two, they were willing to pay a lot to get that data because they were making money. So front running does happen. It happens with index changes. We don't talk about it. You know, the Russell rebalance is a big one where if those weren't published in advance, you'd probably see different performance out of those securities. But if you own, as we said, let's call it 30 to 50 names for all between the two portfolios, if I have a large position in something and can't trade out of it in a single day, someone can see that if I'm publishing the holdings every day. And quite frankly, if they can see it, they can get ahead of it. The other thing they can do, Nate, is they can free ride. They could just rebuild the portfolio because it's not that big. And so 30 names, we could be giving away the quote-unquote IP to anybody if we publish the names, and that's also a fear. We think we have a good methodology, and if you look at the performance since we've launched, it's been very strong. We don't want to give that away.
Okay, so I think your first point, that's really interesting, and you do hear that out there quite a bit with index rebalances, that you'll have the high-frequency traders and other algos out there trying to front-run those trades. To your second point, I guess, what about just the overall challenges of active management? So I know you've seen the performance figures out there, right?
Yep.
They haven't been great. And I know there's some nuance to the numbers. I get that. But if I can paint with a broad brush, I think we would both agree active management has been challenged, at least over the past 10 to 12 years. And so,
absolutely.
And so to your second point, I think the quip that you'll hear with semi-transparent ETFs is, well, active managers are flattering themselves if they think people want to copy these strategies, right? Nobody's sitting around trying to replicate these. So what's your response to that?
Well, let's take a different approach on that, right? The structure itself in ETF is a very neat, novel concept that's still only been around for like 27 years, right? And so just because you put a bad mutual fund into a new novel structure does not make it a good investment vehicle. Let's start there. So the structure itself does not make it this all of a sudden all saving grace. Now, what it can do is make a bad manager look a little better, but what it really can do is make a good manager look even better. And so if you notice, we were very particular about what we launched in this structure. We wanted to put our best foot forward, and when you put your best foot forward, you're putting your best thought process and your best idea and potentially your best IP. Now, I want to say best IP with a caveat. We can only invest in U.S. securities, so we couldn't do our best idea in international, for example.
Well, and hopefully that'll change.
Hopefully. But the idea here is to put your best foot forward and your best thought. So even if you look at the funds, Focus Dynamic Growth, and Focus Large Value does have an SMA. If somebody was curious, they could see the performance of it. If they really wanted to, we could find it. But in reality, they both have done very well over the last few years since they've been out. And it's what we're targeting. We want to put our best foot forward. And here's the other thing. If we look at the last 12 years, Nate, I mean, if you weren't fully invested, you were probably trailing the index. And a lot of active funds carry cash, the mutual funds themselves, specifically because they have to meet redemptions of what's coming in and coming out. The one advantage to the ETF structure is you don't need as much cash. So instead of carrying 3% cash, maybe you carry 1% as a tactical to invest in when markets dip like they are today. And so you can also eliminate some of that cash drag. But in volatile markets, active management is something I would want. I mean, if you look at sectors like consumer discretion, right? Would you want to own that whole sector? Or would you really want to own the best stocks like Amazon, which is still positive for the year when most of the sector is negative?
Ed, in terms of the pricing for these two ETFs, you mentioned earlier FLV at 42 basis points, FDG at 45 basis points. I think obviously very competitive and reasonable for active management. And certainly that lowers the bar to be able to generate outperformance. We know that's been somewhat of a challenge. And I guess on that note, can you tell us anything about the overall pricing strategy? And what I'm particularly interested in is how this pricing might impact the mutual fund side of the equation. Because I think this could be tricky for fund companies, right? If your semi-transparent ETFs are cheaper than the equivalent mutual funds, what's the point of an investor using the mutual fund wrapper? I think if nothing else, the ETF wrapper will be more tax efficient, right? You do have the ability to buy and sell during the day. Any insight you can offer here just in terms of the overall pricing strategy?
Sorry, I lost you for a second, Nate.
Yeah, no, I was just asking about the overall pricing strategy for these ETFs and really in comparison to the mutual fund. So if you're offering equivalent mutual funds, sort of what's the point of an investor using those, right? Because the ETF wrapper would be cheaper, it would be more tax efficient, you could trade during the day. So I'm just curious, how does American Century think about that pricing?
Yeah, so the way you think about pricing is if we have an equivalent fund like FDG, you want to take into account, for example, how the costs associated with that fund and try to build what seems like a fair price. Now, ETFs can be a little less expensive in terms of full baked-in costs than a fund can be. So what you're going to see in most cases, I think, and this is with our competitors as well when they come out, is you're going to see ETFs priced at around the lowest share class, so call it a clean share class or an institutional share class, either equal to or a little bit less. And in the case of FDG, we ended up 5 basis points less. Now, the other thing you asked about was, you know, do you really see the use for the mutual fund wrapper? There are instances where the mutual fund wrapper totally makes sense. And you have to think about that, right? 529 plans, I can't use an ETF in there. 401k plans, still can't really use an ETF in there. Dollar cost averaging, while the platforms are starting to get closer to looking like an ETF, for example, commission-free, so there's no cost. And then you get to the other piece, which is there are some platforms which are going to allow fractionals, not all of them, but a couple of them. That makes dollar cost averaging a little bit easier, but it's still not systematic. You know, investing $300 a month or $100 a month into a specific fund, you're not going to be able to do that with an ETF right away. So there are instances where the ETF and doesn't make sense, and the mutual fund will.
Ed, going back to the semi-transparent ETF structure itself, I mentioned earlier that you're using Precidian's active shares.
Yeah.
Now, as I know you're well aware, there are several other structures out there that have been approved by the SEC, and they all help protect the intellectual property in one way or another. The question I have is, do you think all of these structures can be successful, or do you see this as sort of a winner-take-all scenario?
So to be candid and fair, Nate, we have licensed one of the other structures. One of the proxy basket structures, the NYSE structure that we've been public about. I do think that there's room for all of these to survive. I'm not sure. This is the hard part. It's going to come down to consumer preferences, and I've been comparing this a lot to, when the MP3 players came out. Originally, everyone had a different MP3 player, and before the phones really dominated with music, we all ended up slowly gravitating towards Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't think that's the case, because if you look at the end investor, I'm not sure they're going to care, right? I mean, the first thing we talked about with Precidians was people don't care about the holdings, right? They're going to care. And there's places I've looked at with websites where they have specifically told me only 15% of their users look at the holdings. And my bet is half of that is industry people, because I've had analysts over the years who didn't have the tools we didn't pay for, so they went to these websites to look at those holdings. And that's where they did all their research. So let's say the number is 10, just for example. So you eliminate that. Then do people actually, if they don't care about the holdings, do they really understand the mechanics to care? Or are they really going to be focused on the strategy of the ETF itself to really drive that home? And I think that's where people are going to look most. If the strategy makes sense, they're not going to care about the structure. They're going to care about, does it fit in my portfolio? Does it trade well? Right? Can I get in? Can I get out? And quite frankly, does it counteract anything else I'm owning, or how does it parlay with what I own?
All right. So I'm really glad you brought this up, because I saw similar comments that you made to CNBC a couple of weeks ago, sort of regarding the daily transparency of traditional ETFs. And I actually read these on the podcast last week. But let me do that again. I have the quote here. So you said, quote, "I was checking with some of the main websites that publish the holdings of every ETF and asked them what percentage of people that visit the site actually look at the holdings. And it's way lower than I anticipated. They said it was only 15%. So if you eliminate the people that really look for holdings, this is just an ETF to everyone else." So I guess to what you were saying, to me, it sounds like you think the daily transparency of holdings is overrated. Is that a fair assessment?
I do. So I'm going to use Focus Dynamic Growth as the example why, right? So our start date was 3/31, right? We publish the top 10 holdings every month, 10 days after month end. The top 10 holdings make up somewhere around 45 to 50% of the fund. So you can easily see that. The holdings actually were published on 4/15, So anyone can see them if they wanted to. And quite frankly, even on our own site, almost no one's looked at the holdings yet. So no one's actually digging into the holdings. What they're digging into is the philosophy and the strategy and seeing how it fits. And I think you see that. This is just an example of this ETF, but I think you see that with more and more ETFs as we go through. I think the transparency, it's great because it actually can help some people make a decision, but it's not the majority of people. And I think what you're getting to is people really want to understand the manager's philosophy. And quite frankly, if it's not a basic index, everyone I've talked to really digs into the methodology of, let's say, you know, an alternatively weighted ETF, mm-hmm. some rules-based process. They don't look at the holdings. They want to know how you get to the holdings more than what the holdings are. And I think that's the most important aspect. What is the manager doing, whether it's an alternatively weighted or it's active? How do you get to those holdings? And that, to me, seems to be the more important aspect. So I don't think the transparency is as important as everyone has made it out to be.
Well, and I think along with that, you know, I'll hear, if you're a long-term investor, should you really be looking at every single holding every single day? Obviously, you should understand the strategy. You should understand whatever the index is you're tracking. If it's an index-based product, understand the manager's objective if it's actively managed. But, you know, otherwise, if you're a long-term investor, does it really matter? Again, if you can crawl in and see the holdings every day. I think, to your point, there's some debate on that. Ed, just a minute left. Before I let you go, I have to get to the question that I know everyone wants answered. So I've been calling your ETFs semi-transparent throughout our discussion because I know that's how American Century refers to them. But yeah, if I'm being honest, I've lazily referred to these just as non-transparent ETFs. I think just because that's what they were called from the very beginning. Now, I think Bloomberg is calling these ANTS, which stands for active non-transparent. I've seen CFRA and ETF.com say these should just be called active equity ETFs. Ben Johnson over at Morningstar says active non-transparent. I'm going to put this to you. What should these be called?
I mean, to give my honest answer here, right, I think they should just be called ETFs in general because that's what they are. But if you really have to go with a label and go beyond that, semi-transparent to me makes the most sense. And the reason is because there's data out there. As I mentioned, the top 10 holdings are out there every month. There is an INAV out there, which is called the VIIV. Instead of being published every 15 seconds, it's published every second, and anyone can look it up. So they know the value of the securities in the portfolio every second. So there is some transparency, not necessarily to the holdings, but the valuations. And that's why I think if you really wanted to dig into a label beyond ETF, it should be semi-transparent.
All right. So we'll put one in the semi-transparent vote category. Hopefully at some point we can all converge to some sort of common nomenclature on these. I do think they'd be helpful just for the end investor, just from an investor education standpoint. But Ed, really enjoyed the conversation this week. Congratulations on the launch of the two semi-transparent ETFs and certainly look forward to visiting again soon. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
That was Ed Rosenberg, head of ETFs at American Century Investments. I'm now joined by Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise Investments, who's a leading provider of rules-based exposure to the crypto asset space. They're also one of the firms that's been working to bring a Bitcoin ETF to market. And Matt is on the line with me from San Francisco. Matt, always great to connect.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
All right, so first I have to ask you, how are you doing? How's your family doing? Tell us about your work from home setup. How's everything going right now?
I appreciate that question. I'm doing well. The family's all healthy and safe. We're obviously going a little stir crazy. I have a nice office in my home, fortunate to have that. And about every 30 minutes, a kid comes in. Fortunately, they're still mostly asleep. So we should be okay for this call. You doing okay?
I am, yeah. I'm pretty much in the exact same boat, but we're hanging in there, and hopefully we can get to, I mentioned at the top of the show, just some semblance of normalcy sooner rather than later. Okay, so let's start with what I thought was a pretty big announcement from Bitwise a few weeks ago, which was that you are now seeking approval to make the Bitwise 10 index fund accessible in traditional brokerage accounts. So that would be places like Schwab, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade. What can you tell us about this?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We're really excited about this. Obviously, we launched the fund as a private investment accessible only to accredited investors in 2017. And we've been looking for ways to broaden access to it so that anyone can access to it and also make it easier to access. Right now, there's a lot of paperwork involved, a lot of bank wires. We wanted to make it accessible through traditional brokerage accounts. The way you can do that with private investments is to make them tradable through the OTC markets. You might know GBTC. I know we've talked about it before. That's an example of a private fund that is tradable through the OTC markets, which lets traditional regular investors access it the same way they would a traditional stock or a traditional ETF by putting a buy order into their brokerage account.
And do you mind just briefly explaining the OTC markets, the over-the-counter markets? What are these?
Sure. OTC markets have been around for about 100 years. OTC stands for over-the-counter. It's a bulletin board service that allows you to match orders between private investors. Now, there are some big companies that trade on the OTC markets, things like Tencent, companies like Burberry. There are a number of large companies that trade there, but it's not a national securities exchange. It's not the NYSE. It's not NASDAQ. It's a private bulletin board matching location.
And so you mentioned the grayscale products. I mean, essentially, would this work in the same format where shares are first offered to accredited investors and then they have the ability to go sell those on the OTC market after, you know, a lockup period?
That's correct. So you can create on a primary basis at the net asset value as an accredited investor with Bitwise. And then after those shares season for a one-year period, they can be traded on the OTC markets. Now, the issue that causes, because there's that one-year lag, is you can see these products trade to premiums and potentially discounts. And that's an unfortunate reality, but it is a reality. The flip side of that is they're easier to access and they're available to all investors. So there's good and bad on both sides of the coin, and that's what's going on here.
Matt, obviously I've been a longtime advocate for a Bitcoin ETF, and we're all aware that one has not yet been approved. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some listeners are asking themselves, what's the distinction here? Like, why will the SEC allow this product to trade over the counter but not allow a Bitcoin or crypto ETF?
that's a $10 million question, right? Look, I can't speak for the SEC, but I think it's important to realize that this is not an ETF. And the OTC markets are not nationally regulated securities exchanges like NYSE. So the SEC has specific rules around listing an ETF, has to qualify under the Exchange Act, their various investor protections. And then they have other rules about the transfer of private securities. I think one way to think of it is the SEC doesn't feel comfortable giving its stamp of approval that an ETF meets that higher, that Bitcoin market meets that higher bar that would allow it to be an ETF. And this is under a different kind of jurisdiction that allows it to be transferred through the OTC markets. And that's a signal to investors that probably there's a higher level of due diligence required here. So I used to really have issues with the GBT structure for the very reason you just called out. It seemed like there is these two different things. An ETF couldn't exist, but someone could access GBTC through a brokerage account. I now recognize it's really just two different platforms with two different signals, and hopefully we'll get to the point where the SEC is comfortable enough with the Bitcoin market to allow an ETF to exist. In the time being, this is the best way to have broad-based access and exposure to an important area of the market like crypto.
If all goes well with a Bitwise product on the over-the-counter markets, there are other products out there trading, does that help bolster the case for a Bitcoin or crypto ETF at all?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know for sure. For one thing about the Bitwise product, it's an index product, right? What differentiates our product from GBTC is we don't just hold Bitcoin. We hold the 10 largest crypto assets weighted by market cap. And the SEC isn't evaluating or close to considering allowing an ETF on any crypto asset beyond Bitcoin. So I think it's really a separate thing. Now, does it show that there's broad-based demand for well-structured investments in the crypto space. I think it could show that. But I think we know that. We feel confident about that. So it's really two different things to my mind.
Let's just say the SEC does come around on this at some point. Is it possible that this Bitwise index fund could then be converted into a traditional ETF?
Oh, interesting question. We haven't gotten that far in our analysis. I know that other private funds that have gone through this have ideas about that. We're not there yet. Really, this is just about allowing all investors to access an index fund in crypto through their traditional brokerage account.
Yeah, which, by the way, I've seen that fund referred to as the S&P 500 of crypto, which I love. Did you consider launching just a Bitcoin-only version of this, or would that be something you would consider?
It could be something we would consider down the line. We really think this product is differentiated. This will be the only true index fund with a true index committee behind it. As you said, the S&P 500 of crypto that's available to retail investors. Down the road, could we launch a Bitcoin-only fund? We could. We have a Bitcoin-only private fund right now that's custodied with Fidelity Digital Assets. So that could be something we're looking at down the road. But first and foremost, you know, my view, as you and I have discussed, is the best approach to crypto is to own a basket, because you don't know what's going to happen exactly. And so we wanted to make that product available to all investors first.
Okay. Any sense as to what the timing of approval might be for that product?
Yeah, we're hopeful that it'll happen in the second half of this year. So things are marching along well so far. And sometime in the second half, we hope to see it trading on the OTC markets.
Okay. And before we move on, because I do want to talk investment case for Bitcoin in particular, while I have you on the line, I have to ask you, can you tell us anything about where the proposed Bitcoin Bitwise ETF currently stands?
Yeah. So we withdrew our application, but that doesn't mean we've withdrawn our efforts. We are working 24/7. I can assure you that. Before the coronavirus lockdown, we were in D.C. on a monthly basis. The SEC is working hard on this. We are doing extensive research. So it is marching forward. Don't think because you can't see anything publicly that it's ground to a halt. The truth is not that. We're using this home lockdown to make real progress. So I continue to think we will get there. It's a matter of when and not if. I think it's probably sooner than a lot of people think. But is it going to happen, you know, over the summer? It's not going to happen over the summer. But we are working hard on it.
This morning, I was trying to determine whether or not everything going on with the oil exchange-traded products was a good or bad thing for Bitcoin ETF. And, you know, I can't help myself with kind of throwing the jab out there. I do feel like if a product like USO exists, it doesn't make any sense to me that a Bitcoin ETF doesn't exist. But I digress. So, okay, let's talk about the investment case for Bitcoin in particular. And maybe we can take this in two pieces. We can first talk about how Bitcoin handled the recent market turmoil, because I feel like this was really the first time Bitcoin had been tested in a true panic-type environment. Yeah. And then we can also talk about the investment case moving forward. So back at the end of February, when the market first started declining, I actually tweeted out that Bitcoin did not seem to be acquitting itself very well as a hedge. And the reason for that is, you know, I think stocks were down about 13% at that point. But Bitcoin was down somewhere close to that. Now, right. If we look year to date, I think Bitcoin, last I checked, it was around flat. Of course, stocks are still down. But can you talk about what we saw during the turmoil, and then what should the expectations be for Bitcoin as a hedge?
Yeah, great. Great question. Look, going into this crisis, there were two theses on Bitcoin, I think you could say. One was that it's a risk asset. Because it's this young, unproven technology. And the other is that it's a hedge asset that protects against geopolitical risk and inflation risks and other risks. And what we learned through the crisis is that it's both. Look, year to date, it strongly outperformed equities, which is incredible. We're living through a period where the VIX was at 80, where oil traded to negative 37, where the treasury market locked up. And you have this early stage venture capital style investment that's beating the S&P 500. That is an amazing track record. But I don't want to paper over the fact that during the worst of the crisis, Bitcoin traded as a risk asset. Correlations went to one and beta went high, right? At a point in March 12th, March 13th, Bitcoin traded down to $4,000 for a minute. So you have to keep in mind that it's both a risk asset and a hedge asset. During quiet periods in the market, the hedge asset and the fundamentals behind Bitcoin shine, which is why it's up year to date. But on days like today, where we're grappling with an oil market collapse, that risk factor drives short-term returns. So you see Bitcoin down. So I'm really pleased with how it's performed because, as you said, it had only existed essentially in a bull market, a 10-year bull market. If you had told me VIX would go to 80 and the S&P 500 would have its worst three-week period in history, how would Bitcoin do? I would have told you it would have been down sharply. It's not. It's about flat for the year. So that's incredible, but it is a risk asset. And during moments of crisis, it does trade at a correlation of one, and the beta is high. And both of those things are true at the same time, which makes my brain hurt, but it's just reality.
Matt, if we could just get a little bit more specific, and I just want to be clear for investors who may be considering Bitcoin or crypto, what exactly do you view Bitcoin as a hedge against?
Yeah, great. Mostly I view Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation and inflationary risks. I view it slightly as a hedge against geopolitical risks, slightly as a hedge against the politicization of currency, which is something that's happening in the world, but mostly as an inflationary risk hedge, which is important because what we're seeing right now is massive deflation. You know, oil trading to negative 37 isn't an inflationary event. We've seen inflation expectations come way in. Now, the reason I think Bitcoin is exquisitely interesting now is we've had so much monetary stimulus, so much Fed activity, so much fiscal stimulus, not just in the U.S., but around the world, that the potential for policy error and significant inflation down the road is high. Now, there's also a potential for deflation, so you have a wider range of outcomes. But I think having a small allocation to Bitcoin to protect yourself if what we end up with is runaway inflation makes more sense today than it has at any time in the past. So there's a higher probability of seeing that runaway inflation when the Fed's balance sheet has gone from $3 trillion to $6 trillion effectively overnight and is on its way to $10 trillion.
Well, and I think I saw you say recently that you can't buy insurance when your house is already on fire, right? And it's the same thing here if you're looking for a potential inflation hedge down the road with everything the Fed is doing, the stimulus from Congress. There's no question there's a school of thought out there that perhaps this could be inflationary down the road. Matt, just a few minutes left, and you know, we can talk about Bitcoin as a potential inflation hedge, but can you talk just high level about the potential benefits of owning Bitcoin or crypto in a traditional stock bond portfolio? And I think most people listening to this podcast are probably, they're not going to be diehard crypto enthusiasts, but certainly there's some interest there. So why should they consider crypto in a portfolio?
Yeah, we have a white paper that's coming out on this in about a week or so, so stay tuned. But the short message is it's the ultimate alternative asset. Look, it combines over any long period of time low correlation with the S&P 500 and all risk assets, high potential returns, and liquidity, which means you can rebalance it. And if you put it into a traditional 60-40 portfolio at a small amount, say 2.5%, and you rebalance it, there has never been a three-year period where it didn't add to your risk-adjusted returns. Even on a two-year period, it's added to your returns in 97% of the cases. And even, Nate, if you bought it on December 16th, 2017 at its all-time high and rode it to today, as long as you rebalance with a monthly, quarterly, annually tolerance base, doesn't matter, as long as you had a rebalancing strategy in place, it still added to your returns and lowered your risk, even though you bought it on the worst day ever and Bitcoin is down 50 or 60%. When you have a volatile asset that has low correlation and you rebalance, it's the proverbial free lunch, and it doesn't take much. It's only 2.5% of your portfolio. I think most investors should look at it, remove the crypto stigma from it, and evaluate it just as a portfolio asset. And they will want some exposure to it in a disciplined fashion.
Well, and I want to emphasize something you just said. It doesn't take a huge allocation. You mentioned 1 or 2%. I've seen some of the different studies out there in terms of what it can do to your risk-adjusted returns, and it's pretty eye-opening just because of the volatility and then the longer-term returns that it's produced, and that it is an uncorrelated asset. So to your point, I mean, that really is the only free lunch in investing. So, Matt, excellent stuff as always. And I do want to mention, I really appreciate all the work and the research that you and your team do, all of the different stuff you put out. I think it's very helpful from an education perspective. So certainly keep up the good work there. Always enjoy chatting. Appreciate you taking the time this week. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. Anytime.
That was Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise Investments. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, if you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate a quick review wherever you listen to the show. We also always appreciate direct feedback as well. You can submit that through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by Phil McInnes, Director of Investments at Avantis Investors. We're going to spotlight their entire suite of ETFs. And then Eric Irvin, CEO of BlackForce Capital and Reality Shares, will talk alternative investments, including the Reality Shares Dividend Defender ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.